Case number 12-3069, United States of America v. Tom Lasulli Molina, appellant. Ms. Jeffries for the appellant, Mr. Ewing for the appellee.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. With respect to the issues in the supplemental briefing, it's our position that there is no statutory grant of authority to the district court to impose conditions of supervised release in cases where there is a D.C. code conviction only.
And I assume your argument covers sentencing as well.
Well, Your Honor, I mean, actually, maybe not, in this respect, which is that the statute that places district courts in the shoes of superior court for the purpose was an act of Congress, which was 11-5023.
Right. It doesn't talk about sentencing or about conditions on supervised release, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. It doesn't mention that. Well, the issue here, I mean, supervised release in particular, I think, is a creature of statute. And, well, let me start with saying, in Superior Court, obviously...
Well, sentencing is more.
Right. Well, our position is that statute essentially puts the district court in the shoes of Superior Court for D.C. code offenses. And Superior Court, of course, they do sentence. They impose a term of incarceration, and they impose the length of the term of supervised release. What they don't do, and therefore what the district court here wasn't empowered to do, is the additional step of imposing conditions of supervised release.
But you don't find any authority for the parole commission, the U.S. Parole Commission, to impose supervised release conditions, right?
Not on someone convicted of
parole.
It's a
total gap.
It's a gap. That's exactly right.
Why would you read it that way? I mean, you know that the district court has authority to impose the term
yes.
of supervised release, and so you're essentially reading it to say that they can impose a term and that no one can impose conditions or no one can actually engage in the supervision. Doesn't that seem to create an absurdity in the statute that we should fill?
Well, I think someone should fill it. But I don't think it can be this court. This is an area where you're talking about something very fundamental to this process. We're talking about a district court's authority to act.
Right. So the choices are give the district court authority to set the conditions, give the parole commission authority to set the conditions, or say no one can exercise the supervision and set conditions. Right. Those are our three choices, right?
And meanwhile, offer a consistent explanation on the treatment of sentences.
Right. I mean, I think the last one is where we end up. Now, there is an option there, which is a legislative fix. And I think that's the only option in a circumstance like this. U.S. Your Attorney's Office is able to work with their liaisons in that respect, and that's what's required here. I mean, again, I think we're working in an area where, we're talking about the district court's authority to act, and jurisdictional or grants such as this have to be expressed and they have to be clear, and there's just nothing coming close to empowering a district court to impose supervised release conditions in these cases.
Right. So I guess I'm leaning in your favor on that, although not decided, just speaking for myself, but troubled by the idea that the parole commission couldn't set the conditions.
Well, I think that may be an issue for another day, but their own regulations say that they can only supervise or are only empowered to set the conditions for those convicted of offenses in the superior court. So,
right. The provision, I mean, there's those provisions. The provision before it, talking about the agency, refers to all violations of the D.C. code, right? And so there's kind of a back and forth between the D.C. code and the imposed by the superior court there. And it seems, it doesn't seem crazy for me for the court to read that and say, well, the way to read that together to make sense, to not be absurd, would be that the parole commission could set the conditions for D.C. code sentences imposed by the U.S. District Court as well.
Well, I think we'd have to disregard the regulation in order to get there. We'd have to completely disregard.
So the parole commission—that's a parole commission problem, though, right?
But the other thing is, this creates an Article III problem.
Right. That's a whole separate.
I mean, it's best avoided. I mean, a sentencing court, an Article III court, obviously cannot delegate.
That's best avoided by choosing option one, isn't it? Saying the district court should sit, the best way to put all this together and make sense of it, avoid absurdity, is to say the district court should set the condition.
Well, I mean, the district court can only act according to an express grant of authority, though, in 3551, right, which is the federal statute, obviously excludes.
Right, that's why I'm leaning your way on that one.
Right. Okay. So, I mean, I really think this is something that needs attention from the legislature. There needs to be some decision made about who's going to do it, and whether it's the parole commission or the district court, that's something they can take up in the first instance. But in terms of what this court's role is, there's just no grant of authority.
And the council could fix 24133, right? Where it says the agency or the parole commission shall have and exercise the same authority as is.
Right.
They could just make clear that that applies to sentences imposed under the D.C. Code, not just by the D.C. Superior Court, right?
You're right, Your Honor. I think it would be relatively simple, and I think it could pretty much be made to that, and then the parole commission would have to deal with its regulations.
Well, that would take them a day, probably. We would hope.
And then the interaction between the court, sentencing court, hands-on supervisor of supervised release would be between what?
I'm sorry. The district court's role in supervising thereafter?
It's supervising the supervisors, really.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, as way I understand it works with the Superior Court is parole commission after the district court imposes the length of the term of supervised release. The only thing the judge and Superior Court will ever do thereafter is perhaps extend the term of supervised release. Everything else is handled by the parole commission.
And it would be the Superior Court would extend the term?
Yeah.
But previously had nothing to do with the case?
That presents its own problems. I mean, that transfer of authority presents its own problems. I mean, I know judges can't do certain things here under the federal rules unless they're familiar with the entire record, so putting it to another judge in another jurisdiction would present its own problems. I mean, it needs to be looked at.
So the other fix is to put the district court to set the conditions, but your point is that the federal law doesn't contemplate that right now for D.C. code violations.
In fact, I think it speaks expressly to that issue.
Right, 3551A.
That's correct.
Thank you. You answered me, but what's your answer on how we find or do we not find any sentencing power in the district court?
Well, I think we can find it in respect that
it's again, expressly excluded by 3551, right?
That
is to say the application of 227 is excluded by 3551.
Yeah, if there's a grant, I think the grant was in 11-5023, and just so far as it said, district courts are essentially in the same shoes as the Superior Court, so they can do everything a Superior Court judge can do. But that includes sentencing. But it doesn't include, obviously, setting the conditions of release, which creates this.
I guess the question is why do you leap to the conclusion they can step only into the shoes of the Superior Court, not into the entire process of imposing sentence?
It depends on how you read 5023 as extending that far, and certainly the whole scheme doesn't make much sense if they can't sentence. But I think supervised release is another issue where there's specific federal statutes on that and a specific way that it's handled in the Superior Court. So that's something that there is no grant of authority for them to do here. Whereas I think 5023 can be read as giving the district court that power, because Superior Court judges have that power.
That's slicing it pretty thin, but I
don't know who's raised this issue. Did criminal courts of common law impose something like supervised release conditions on supervised?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe so. I think it was probation or incarceration. That's my understanding. I also think you know, what is clear is that, at least they've said many times, is that supervised release is a creature of statute. So in terms of what we're looking at now, what does the statute say and who does it apply to? I think in this case it speaks very clearly.
If we agree with the way that you parse the statutory scheme, what would happen then? Would we reverse and remand?
Yeah, and I think that under these circumstances, his conditions would have to be vacated, and then, you know, we can see what happens in the future with how they treat this particular problem in terms of a legislative fix.
Well, we've used all of your time on this quirky jurisdictional question. Did you want to say anything on the merits?
I did want to talk about the conditions, if I could, Your Honor. I think, as the district court's comments concerning Mr. Melania at the sentencing made quite clear, this is somebody with a lot of promise who can contribute in very positive ways to his adopted country here. And he was doing so prior to this unfortunate incident. But his ability to reintegrate himself and to be a productive member of society here will be very much undermined by the conditions imposed in this case, which do not meet 3583D. And relatedly, I think, as stated in United States versus Russell, affirmatively and aggressively interfere with the goal of rehabilitation. I want to just touch briefly on the conditions. The standard of review here, I think, is abuse of discretion with respect to almost all of these. But there's another factor here, which is that a lot of these impact, you know, constitutional rights. Mr. Melania's rights under the First Amendment, and including his rights of association with people like his own family members, his nieces and his nephews, etc. Chief Justice Roberts recognized this constitutional dimension in United States versus Stanfield when he was on this court. And Justice Sotomayor agreed with this point in United States versus Myers, which is the court's application of 3583D has to reflect the heightened constitutional concerns when you're dealing with something like what someone can read, who they can associate with, can they spend time with their family members. These are obviously things that completely undermine someone's ability to have a productive life or marginally enjoyable one. On the computer restriction, that restriction begins, you shall not possess or use a computer, and I think that part of the restriction is a no-brainer, as this court made clear in United States versus Russell. A condition that Mr. Melania can't have a computer that is not connected to the Internet is obviously overbroad. And even in United States versus Love, where the defendant used the Internet to distribute child pornography and to solicit sex with someone he believed was a 10-year-old minor, no one banned him from a computer. I think the government hasn't cited a single case from this court where a computer restriction has ever been upheld. And Russell, they overturned it, and the government even conceded error in that case. Now, moving on to the Internet prohibition, that's not reasonably related to the facts and circumstances of the offense here. There is zero evidence that Mr. Melania has ever in his life used the Internet for illegal activity. So the restrictions clearly fail 3583D's reasonable relation prong. They also fails the second prong of 3583D, which is that it restricts far more liberty than what's necessary. In Russell, this court referred to it as the Internet is permeating everyday life, and I think that becomes more true every day. Obviously, the vast majority of Americans use the Internet in some form or fashion every day. So the idea that the government that a probation officer could completely bar Mr. Melania from using the Internet in any form or fashion is inconsistent with this court's precedent, but also just violates 3583D. I just want to say the government seems to think it's safe by granting the probation officer the ability to make an exception. There are two arguments against this, compelling ones. One is practical and one is constitutional. I think the practical one is what this circuit recognized in Stanfield again, which is where it stated that, quote, open-ended delegations to probation officers create opportunities for arbitrary action, opportunities that are especially worrisome when the subject concerns what people may read. And this is true, and you think about it in experience, probation officers, the very safest course for a probation officer is to, of course, ban someone from using the Internet in all respects. That's the safest course and would most likely prevent them from ever doing anything wrong on the Internet. So the idea that I think permeates the government's brief that these probation officers are always going to grant permission, there's absolutely no reason to think that. And also more to the point, there's no reason to give a probation officer the kind of power if we don't want them to ever exercise it in that manner. The second argument against that is constitutional one, which is that it's an unconstitutional delegation, and I think I've already referred to that in the other respect. The Third Circuit said that best in United States versus Pruden, and I would rely on the discussion there, which is that giving this kind of power to a non-judicial officer is inconsistent with Article 3, the delegation of sentencing authority. On the adult pornography case, and in the adult pornography, I think this condition really underscores the lack of any reasoning that went into the district court's formulation of these conditions. Adult pornography has nothing to do with this case. It's not grounded in any way in the nature and circumstances of the offense or the history and characteristics of the offender. And this is why, this goes back to the district court's statement at the sentencing, which was, I'm imposing these conditions because these are standard conditions in these cases. That was incorrect as a matter of law, and it was incorrect under 3583D. And I think a perfect example of a symptom of that thinking about how these conditions worked is the pornography one, which just has nothing to do with this case. All right. Thank you.
I think we understand your argument.
Okay.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, James Ewing for the United States. The district court had jurisdiction to both sentence appellant and to impose the conditions of supervised release pursuant to the U.S. Code or pursuant to the D.C. Code. That authority comes from D.C. Code 11-502 subsection 3 and this court's holding in Cutchin. In Cutchin, this court said that when a defendant is sentenced in federal district court for a violation of the U.S. Code, then that individual will be sentenced pursuant to the D.C. Code. And here, appellant was, in all substantive aspects, sentenced pursuant to the D.C. Code. The judge looked at to the D.C. Code, for example, for the maximum punishment as far as length of confinement, looked at the D.C. Code for the maximum fine, even ordered the mandatory $100 payment to the D.C. Superior Court Victims of Violent Crime Fund. Now, as you go to the supervised release provisions, we acknowledge that there's a procedural difference between the two, but substantively, if you look at the two schemes, if you look at the D.C. Code scheme for supervised release and you look at the federal scheme for supervised release, they come back substantively to the same place, and that is 18 U.S. Code Section 3583. Because if you look at D.C. Code...
Well, it says to look through for D through I, not C, right? There's a slight difference there.
Yes, Your Honor, that's right. But D is the substantive provision that points the court to 3553
right.
That talks about the sentencing factors that are to be applied in the supervised release context. So really all we're talking about here, we're not talking about, there's certainly a difference between the two schemes, and we acknowledge that. But there's not a substantive difference between
what? I don't know if substance and procedure, I know that's been the way you've distinguished this, but I don't know that really gets you that far, because just if you read the statutes together, you start with 3551, seems to exclude the federal authority for a D.C. Code violation for this, and then if you go to the D.C. Law provisions, they seem to make pretty clear that the parole commission, if anyone, has authority for supervised release here, if you read those provisions together, for D.C. Code violations.
Right.
And I don't know, calling it substance, calling it procedure, I'm not sure really advances the ball if the code says the parole commission shall have the authority.
To amplify Judge Kavanaugh's question, I didn't think your citations to Belt and Brown got you very far.
Okay, Your Honor, I certainly agree with your reading of the D.C. Code, and that it gives the ability of the U.S. Parole Commission to supervise individuals sentenced in D.C. Superior Court. But, Your Honor, I respectfully disagree with your reading of 3551, and here's why. 3551 prescribes to the federal district court that the federal district court must sentence individuals who have pled guilty or been found guilty of an offense pursuant to Title 18 of the U.S. Code, pursuant to the provisions of Chapter 227 of the U.S. Code. That's what it says. And it also says, except for the D.C. Code and except for the Uniform Code of Military Justice. Well, we already know from Cutchin that that's the case. We already know from Cutchin that if you're being sentenced pursuant to the D.C. Code, then you're being sentenced pursuant to the substantive provisions of the D.C. Code. So nothing, so that's not news. That's just kind of the, that's 3551 stating the obvious. You know, what 3551 doesn't say is that it doesn't say that the district court judge may not use any federal court procedures when sentencing or handling a matter under the D.C. Code pursuant to D.C. Code 11-502 subsection 3. And that was the reason, Your Honor, for our cites to Belt and Brown.
Do you have an answer to the question I asked Mr. Jeffers? And that is historical antecedents of supervised release.
Your Honor,
in other words, in reading 502.3, it might be natural to read it as encompassing a sort of powers that a court with jurisdiction over an offense had with respect to that offense and the offender. And your argument might be easier if you could point to common law practices relating to letting a prisoner out, but retaining some sort of tie on it without regard to, without an explicit basis in statute.
Right, Your Honor. Well, our position would be 11-502 subsection 3, coupled with Cutchin, does give the district court judge the authority to adjudicate the case to include sentencing. So to the extent that I think your question goes to whether that authority reaches supervised release as kind of a matter of common law or it doesn't. In these two schemes, supervised release is certainly a creature of statute. I think in common law, we've had concepts of probation and parole and those sort of things have long been, a part of the sentencing authority of courts. So to the extent that the court has the authority to adjudicate the whole case to include sentencing, then that would include that. I don't have any specific authority to point you to, Your Honor. What we're really looking at is, and this goes to our cite to the Summerlin case, is what we're really looking at here is a choice of decision maker. Is the decision maker on the conditions of supervised release the federal district court judge, or is it the U.S. Parole Commission? And in Summerlin, the Supreme Court said choices of decision maker are quintessentially procedural questions in nature. So it doesn't go to kind of any substantive difference between the two schemes. And that allows us to look at that, avoid this absurd result.
So what that it's procedural, not substantive?
Well, because this goes to our site, to Belt and to Brown and to those type of cases, because when we're adjudicating a D.C. code offense in federal district court, there are instances where this court has held that procedural aspects can be applied, and so it goes to that. So if you take the fact that this is not a substantive difference, because under either scheme, you wind up in the same place. You wind up at 18 U.S.C. 3583. Either way. And it's interesting.
Do you know why a law was set up originally to give the Parole Commission authority for the Superior Court cases to set the conditions of supervised release?
I don't have anything on point for that, Your Honor, as a... this is obviously outside the record, but I practice in Superior Court regularly, and my thinking on that is it was probably a volume issue, and that they wanted to get the Superior Court judge out of the business of setting all these conditions so they could kind of move on to the next case. That's outside the record, but that's my thought on that. So, at the end of the day, we don't have a substantive difference between the two schemes. All we have is kind of the choice of decision maker, and Summerlin tells us that that's a procedural matter.
Right, but the procedure is important, and it might be that the Parole Commission does sentencing supervised release conditions much different from how the district court does. I don't know one way or another on that, but you might want the D.C. violators to be treated similarly regardless of which court they're convicted in.
Certainly the procedures are different, but Summerlin was talking about the decision maker being a jury or a judge, also very different. So in that instance, it was still seen as a procedural matter. And so, that is why we believe that you know, we think it's very clear that the district court had the authority to sentence appellant. And as to the supervised release, because you end up, if you were to take the, if you were to kind of move the district court judge over to the Superior Court and kind of sit in the shoes of Superior Court judge, and then you look at D.C. Code 24-403 subsection B1, or 403.01 subsection B6, it sends him right back to the U.S. Code. It sends him right back to, sends the U.S. Parole Commission right back to the same place.
Sends the Parole Commission, not the Superior Court
right,
judge.
Right, sends the Parole Commission. So, we're, again, we're back to this concept of, you know, the this choice of decision maker. That's really kind of the only difference between between the two schemes. So for those reasons, we believe that it was proper.
Before you touch on the merits, do you have a position on the Article III objection?
As far as I'm not really understanding your question.
They argue it would be an Article III problem for the Parole Commission to set the conditions of supervised release in this kind of case.
Well, we believe it's proper that the we believe it's proper for the. You mean as far as an improper delegation?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're not asking that that the matter be delegated to the Parole Commission.
I understand that, but if it were, would there be an Article III problem? You may not have a position on that.
I haven't completely thought that through, Your Honor, because we
nor
don't.
Nor have I. Okay, that's
because
all I
again,
know.
We see it kind of staying in the, on the federal side.
Okay.
As to the merits of these. Individual kind of conditions of supervised release, it's just wrong to say that the district court judge kind of did not think about.
Is it clear that the district court judge purported to be applying something called standard restrictions? Second, isn't it clear that the district court judge applied throughout not the balancing test but the special view to preserving the view to it? Preserving liberty, and instead talked frequently about minimizing risk, which is a completely different standard, and that there was an objection for failure to, or saying that he ought to follow the standard set forth in 3583.
Your Honor, I guess I have to take those one at a time. It's true that the judge used the word standard conditions at one point. The judge also said that this was a very difficult case, that he had thought long and hard about it.
I don't know if it gets you very far unless the long, hard thought is directed to particular restrictions.
Well, the fact that these type of restrictions might be standard in this type of case does not necessarily mean that, you know, he's just reading from a list. That actually could potentially lend
well,
additional.
Well, reading from a list, right?
Well, he certainly had information.
That's a list provided by the probation office.
That's correct, Your Honor. But that doesn't necessarily take a.
I understand that. If the probation office hits the nail on the head, that's terrific. No one should be criticized for that.
I guess just to kind of take on this concept that he was kind of not thinking about these and just kind of reading from the list, that's not right, and that's not what the record shows. The record shows that below, these arguments that we've heard today about appellant not using the internet for a nefarious purpose, about appellant not, there's being no evidence that appellant was attracted to children, those were before the district court judge as well. The five of the seven individual conditions of supervised release that are challenged on appeal were challenged either in writing or orally before the district court judge. And, you know, the parties talked through these, they considered them, so this is not something where the district court judge is kind of not thinking about these issues. That was before the district court judge. And the district court judge...
Is there any indication that the district court judge based at all the impact of the internet and computer prohibitions on a human being in the 21st century America? Human being trying to earn a living?
Well, again, Your Honor, that argument was before him through counsel, and so he was considering that. I mean, it wasn't something that he was just kind of out of the blue, as it is in the briefs and here today. He was considering that, and you know, to the extent that we talk about the reasonableness of the computer internet restriction, which is the one that, and I know I'm over my time, but the one that you know, appellant kind of focuses on. What we have here is someone who was searching for sex on the internet, and who we know through his own actions is attracted to children. So
both of you overstate that. There's no indication of his seeking out children. There is clearly an indication that when he became aware that DR was a child, he failed to slam on the brakes, which he ought to have done, obviously. So falls somewhere between no interest in children and zeroing in on children.
Well, Your Honor, I completely agree that he was not kind of initially searching for children, but a child came to his house, and he had sex with that child. Whether or not he knew at the time that the child was 14.
The child had declared himself using a special term to indicate that he looked young, the indication being that he was old. I'll say older than he looked. So, I just think characterizing in a simple way as if he were sort of a straight out pedophile is not correct.
Okay.
By the same token, I object to defense counsel's characterizations.
Right. I mean, we do have some factual finding on that, on the point of the victim's appearance from the district court judge, who reviewed photographs during the sentencing proceeding and said that he looked about like what he is, a 14-year-old child. Now,
I thought it was somewhat different on that.
Yeah. That was at the sentencing proceeding. He did at an earlier proceeding. He indicated, I don't know whether he was looking at the same pictures or not, indicated that he thought the child could be somewhere between 14 and 16. But at the sentencing proceeding,
I think he goes up a bit. I can't find the exact thing, but it's not quite as you said.
Okay. Understood, Your Honor. I guess our point on the computer internet restriction is this. We concede that as an initial matter, appellant was not searching for a child on the internet, but he was searching for sex. He had sex with a 14-year-old child and then was arranging to have sex with that child again. So under those circumstances, it's not unreasonable to want to monitor his internet access. And it's not...
What's the standard on that in terms of how close the relationship to the net have to be? Your whole argument keeps reminding me about things like pencils and paper and glasses and so forth, which play roles ubiquitously in society, enabling people to do things they couldn't otherwise do. Yet we don't see bans on wearing glasses or bans on uses of pencil and paper. Do we?
Right. So if I understand your question correctly, I mean, some of the cases like Burroughs, Peraza, Mercado, Peterson, those type of cases where, for example, the individual met their victims because they were their high school football coach, or because they were their caregiver, or because they were their stepdaughter or something of that nature, then those bans on the internet in those instances have been struck down because the internet had nothing to do with kind of getting together with the victim in those cases. But that's not the case here. I mean, granted, the appellant was not initially kind of searching for a child on the internet, but he was searching for sex, and he ended up having sex with a child. And then, and initially, we think it's important that after the contact over the internet, where they're contacting each other over phone text messages, he's telling that child to cover up. He's telling that child to erase the text messages. He's telling that child to tell his mom, or make sure you don't tell your mom. Keep this top secret.
Maybe you should be banned from text messages.
Well, that just goes to his kind of willingness to cover up.
I understand that, but there may be some useful learning from causation jurisprudence in tort law, where normally, for example, if you sold someone a computer which was then used in the commission of a crime, you would be very rare that you'd be found to be an aider or abettor. I'm sorry, I laughed at a crime. I said I was going to introduce tort. There are similar principles at work.
Right, well,
in terms of necessary causes,
sure.
Sufficient causes, causes that increase the probability of a particular type of behavior.
Agree, Your Honor. And we're not relying on kind of the but-for argument. We're looking into the future, and we're saying that it's reasonable based on what we know about this individual, i.e. that he looks for sex on the Internet and that he is sexually attracted to children, that it's reasonable to want to monitor his Internet access.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor. We would ask that the judgment of the district court be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Ewing. Mr. Jeffress, I know you have no time left, but you can have a minute of rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll be brief. I just want to return to Your Honor's question concerning the district court's ability to sentence. In this case, obviously, Mr. Melania has served his sentence, the incarceration part, and so that's not directly challenged here. But I don't think the government's representation that it's very clear the district court has the ability to sentence under the scheme is necessarily correct. Just because of the same 3551 problem that I know the courts are already aware of, does not say in there, all of these things are a creature of statute at this point in time. Sentence, supervised release, sentencing, everything, and obviously it doesn't grant them the authority to do that, and there's no inherent authority. That much is clear in the law, that there's no inherent authority to do anything like this. On the substance or on
so
the judges...
So what's the bottom line of that argument going forward?
They need to get express authority from the legislature.
Right. Okay.
The government makes a mistake here and made a mistake in the briefs about conflating the judge's 3553 analysis with his 3583D analysis. These are two different statutes with different requirements, and just because the judge said in sentencing the defendant to incarceration one thing does not mean it necessarily. It has to be evaluated according to 3583D's standard, and it's clear the district court just never undertook that second analysis under that. Finally, the government backtracked here to its position in the district court on the Internet restriction, which was simply that he should be monitored. We didn't object to monitoring in the district court, and I think that makes much more sense in terms of the narrow tailoring concept that the district courts have to apply here, that something can be monitored. What we have here in this condition is something much more prohibitive than that. So for all the reasons, we would request that the conditions be vacated. Thank you.
Thank you. The case will be submitted.